It's a nice piece of music. That's Steve Bell, instrumental, you know, a little vocal work in there. Waiting for Adan, the name of the piece. Adan, an ancient Irish monk. But I'm just kind of thinking. I remember reading the liner notes on that album, and I believe that one of the musicians in the band was expecting a child who they named Adan. And I'm suspecting he named that piece after that child. Or maybe it was the other way around. Not sure. We heard from John Angotti, Water from the Rock. We heard from Bart Millard, Mama's Song. And and the Sweet and the Sweet By and By, a rendition of that. 13 and a half minutes now past the hour on this Tuesday morning. Dr. Don joins us. Dr. Don Clark, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, a biochemist in his own right, and a vigneron, and I'm still trying to get those two words right. Vigneron and what's the other one that you do?
Vintner.
Vintner. Okay, that's the making wine part. So that little old winemaker, Don Clark, has joined us this morning and, from Garden Valley, Texas.
Yes. Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning, Dave, and good morning, Jim.
Hello there.
How are you, folks?
We're good. Well, one of us is good.
Well, yeah.
One of us is a little scratchy this morning, but the other one's good.
A little reluctant
I'm good.
To use this
I
voice.
Have a little bit of cold and sniffles coming on last night, so I took a Benadryl, and I don't remember anything happening last night. I was just out. I was gone. Man. Oh. So I don't take a lot of pills.
It works that well, eh? Okay.
I don't take a lot of drugs, and boy, this one just did a job on me. I was out for the night, so.
Well, we're glad you're back in time for the morning show, then.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have slept right past the deadline, yeah.
I saw you. I caught you yawning a little earlier.
Oh that might happen.
Yep.
Well, you get sleepy. I'm sure when the north is frozen like it is now, eh?
Well, it does. You want to? There really is. I don't know what there is about it, but I have this urge to hibernate about this time of the year, and it's about the time the first flurries appear and the ground starts to freeze. You know, come mid to late November, and you just want to sleep. I want to curl up and sleep. I mean, that's actually the way my body reacts to this thing. And I'm thinking, why fight it?
Yeah, that's right.
Go out, look for a few berries, and I'll lie down, curl up, and wake up in April sometime. I think that would be nice. Think it would be nice.
Yeah, when Thanksgiving is almost is coming pretty quickly, so
you have to wake me for that.
Right. Well, you got to recharge. So.
Yeah. Dr. Don, we're talking rock artists this morning, and this has to do with a fairly recent find out in Indonesia, and we're referring to rock paintings, that kind of rock artist. Paintings that happened a long time ago, and who knows by whom. You know, I'm not sure how reliable the information is as to how those paintings came to be. We know that people did it. I mean, it wasn't some chimpanzee that came in, or whatever they have out there in Indonesia. I don't know if they have chimpanzees, but there was some primitive man that came and did some not-so-primitive paintings. There's some rather impressive art on there. Tell us about that, and what is the significance of this art, and I know of other cave paintings in Europe, though they've been known for a long time. Is there a comparison between the two that informs us somehow?
Well, there is, and these cave paintings in Indonesia, and it was in Sulawesi, Indonesia. I'm not sure how to pronounce that, but. It was the surprising thing. They found these back in about 1905 originally. They didn't have cameras back then, so they didn't take the pictures. But it was then followed up years later in about 1950 or so, and recently some analysis was done as far as the age of these paintings. They thought they were a lot younger than what the dating techniques actually turned out that they are, and they're comparable in age to the cave art that's found in Europe. Now, the interesting, I mean, we can talk about the dating method and how old they think they are.
Yeah, I want to get into that. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, the major surprise was that these were about the same age, if not a little older, than the cave paintings in Europe. Now, The significance of that is that they originally thought that, you know, man migrated from Africa, then up to Europe, and then from Europe spread, you know, throughout the world. I mean, that's one story. Of course, we get another story from the Bible, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But with that in mind, they thought, well, you know, cave art or art in general originated from Europe. And so we shouldn't find, with that type of thinking and conclusion, one then shouldn't find cave paintings in Indonesia, as far as away as Indonesia, about the same age. They should be a lot younger than what they actually found. So they said, well, we got to rethink our kind of not necessarily origins of man, but we got to rethink when the first time man actually started painting was. So their conclusion was that man had to have been painting even before he moved into Europe. So if you're moving into Europe, then you're moving into other places, then man probably was painting long before even moving into Europe.
Now, are they using man's ability to paint or to create art as some sort of marker as to their development?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm, so if sure. You've got the if you've got the evolutionary model in mind, then art would probably be something that you would consider. It would develop a little later than the ability to walk upright, for example, and so as well as the ability to communicate in those higher mental abilities, for example. Would come much later than just standing upright. And then, of course, utilizing tools and stuff like that. Mm. Now, so let's... in these cave paintings, interestingly enough, I mean, the reason... I mean, it's obvious that it was done by man because these cave paintings have hands.
Well, yeah.
Kind of stenciled on the paintings, as well as various animals that they either killed or were working with or had domesticated. And, of course, there's ferns and other things.
Yeah, by the way, there's some really neat photographs of these paintings, and we will link them in the podcast that goes up later this morning. It's an article over at Smithsonian.com, and the photographs are pretty awesome. I'm impressed with these.
Yes, they're very, very nice. Let's talk about another model rather than the evolutionary model. Let's talk about the biblical model, and what do we know from the Bible, for example? Well, we know that there was a great flood, of course, after the flood, God told Noah and his sons that to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Well, they were trying to be fruitful, but they were multiplying, but they weren't filling the earth. You get in Genesis 11 where they started building a tower in Babel, and all the peoples of the earth at that time were kind of congregated in this one large city called Babel. And they were building this tower up to God. God saw that, of course, man could do anything. So God had to step in and, the story, he confused the languages, and then man had to disperse after that point. Mm-hmm. So what do we learn from that? Well, we learn that, everybody descended from the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So each of us are either a Japhite or a Hamite or a Shemite. Now, if you're not a Jew or an Arab, then you're probably not a Shemite. Mm-hmm. And if you're not Egyptian or Asian, then you're probably not a Hamite. But those of us with European origins, for example, are Japhites. So we're descendants from Japheth. So if they're building this tower, then they obviously have construction and architectural abilities. And of course, we know that early man, including Adam, was extremely smart, and that wouldn't have been a problem for them. And we also know that speech originally came from God with Adam and Eve. So they spoke from the very beginning. This wasn't something that they needed to develop. And from the account in Genesis about Babel, we then, of course, know that that God was the one who confused the languages. So God gave even more languages to people so that they wouldn't remain in that one location, but they would indeed disperse throughout the earth. And then that dispersion, then you get, you know, you get folks that wind up in Indonesia and other, obviously Europe and other parts and Egypt and, you know, Northern Africa and the Fertile Crescent. Then, you know, it was after the Tower of Babel that man dispersed. So this finding, when I first read the article, I said, wow, you know, this gives a great support to the biblical account that we know from, you know, from the Tower of Babel and what God did at the Tower of Babel and dispersing the peoples and dispersing the, and again, you know, the just, languages
just to,
around
just to
the world.
Simplify the logical trail, if, as a standard paleontologist would have this, or there's another word I'm looking for.
Anthropologist,
yeah. They would have said that the cave paintings in Indonesia had to be far newer because the originators of those people who did the cave paintings would have come from Europe, who already had cave paintings. So they would kind of measure the progression of man along the evolutionary scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we're saying that because they offered these Indonesian paintings seemed to be there at about the same time, that there was some other central point for people to disperse from, which would be then the Middle East someplace, the Fertile Crescent.
Yes, it would have been, you know, wherever the Tower of Babel was. It wasn't in Babylon, they think it was much north of Babylon.
Oh, they do? Okay.
You would think, well, okay, a city named Babylon, you would think that would be the origin of Babel, but apparently there's evidence that it was, you know, further north in that same general region, but, you know, further further north. Anyway, but the people, you know, originating, you know, from that location would be then dispersed throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do they age a painting?
Well, in cases like this, some of the painting is actually done with charcoal, so you can attempt to then do carbon 14 on a little bit of the sample that you take from the cave painting. Now, obviously, you're going to have to destroy whatever sample you're going to take.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't want to do this with all of the cave painting. Then you won't have any cave painting left. So they first attempted to do carbon 14. And lo and behold, they got dates all over the place. And they said, well, you know, there's a number of reasons why carbon 14 isn't giving us accurate dates. It's contaminated with this or contaminated with that. But anyway, we're going to abandon that particular technique because it's not giving us consistent ages. So then they went to another technique, which is actually looking at the amount of uranium in the calcite, which are kind of, since these are caves and they probably seep, you know, water from time to time, the seepage of water through the rock produces calcium carbonate. Well,
now just a minute. If they were to take a sample of the actual material, the colorant on the walls, they would then find out the age of the colorant, but not when the painting itself was done, right?
Well, exactly. Okay. And that's that was the other problem with the carbon-14, is that, okay, we know if we've got this age for the carbon-14, then we know when the tree died. Uh-huh. We don't know when it was actually used to make the cave painting. So the next step was to look at the calcite, the little bubbles that originally, not bubbles, but they're calcium crystals. It's the same material that stalactites and stalagmites are made from, and these little bumps are the beginnings of those in the caves, and so they it has minerals in it, and as well as calcium carbonate. It also has you know, different types of minerals. In this case, they were interested in the uranium, so. Using the amount of uranium in these calcite formations, both above the painting, that is, calcites that formed presumably after the painting was done, and calcite that was found under the painting or formed before the painting was done, or the paintings, then they could take a comparison between the two and get kind of like a window as to when the painting was actually done.
Gotcha.
And so doing that, you know, they got dates, depending on which painting they looked at and where, you know, where it was. And they got, you know, dates 25,000 years ago, and the oldest was about 40,000 years ago. That then, you know, spurred this whole conversation that we're having, that these were the same age as the paintings, the oldest paintings, rock art paintings in Europe.
Now, does that mean that the European paintings had the same window? 25 to, I mean, that's quite a span.
Well, they didn't reference that.
Okay. In the
I think that would depend upon the painting.
Well, yeah. Then, well, I guess they did. The last kind of the bottom of the article, they're saying that some cave paintings in Spain, for example, El Castillo, the El Castillo cave was dated to be maximum about 40,800 years old, and then there were some cave paintings in France that were dated about 20,000 years old.
Okay.
So we're in the same ballpark, same period of time. Now, of course, you know, us young earthers, the ages that they're, you know, proclaiming is off. If you look at the age as a relative type of thing in this type of work, then you can say, well, you know, if relatively speaking, is accurate in at least dating these about the same age, then these peoples arrived in these areas about the same time, started doing these cave paintings. And they were doing them about the same time back in history.
Now, of course, you've taken issue many times with carbon dating. And how about the kind of dating with the calcite? Is that as susceptible to error as carbon-14?
Well, of course it is, because you don't, you don't know what your starting point is. You don't know how much is there.
Mm-hmm.
How much uranium is there? Of course, uranium ultimately degrades to lead with several, about 10, there's 10 different steps before it actually finally degrades to lead. One of them is plutonium, polonium is kind of the first one, uranium gives off an alpha particle and you get polonium. You know, looking at the isotopes, they do isotopic ratios. So either you assume that there was nothing there in the beginning, but in this case, they were assuming, well, okay, we can age the rock, and they probably then age the amount of uranium that was in, obviously, in these calcite. Mm. And then taking a ratio, they figured, oh, okay, it must be about, you know, 40,000 years ago or 25,000 years ago, whatever. Or in that ballpark. But if you're off, especially in the denominator, your number in the denominator, of course, which is the starting amount of uranium that you think you have, then that's going to put your ratio off and give you an incorrect date for the rock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so. And if your decay rate is what we've talked about before, your decay rate, that is uranium to ultimately lead, if those decay rates are off or have changed in the past, then you can, you can't use this technique for an absolute date of anything, much less the absolute date of the Earth, for example.
And that would be something they would be very reluctant to concede that, because that would mean a whole lot of work gets thrown out, doesn't it?
Well, it does. Yeah. It does. You know, conceptually, not that there's anything wrong with it, but you're taking a uniformitarian view, which is the rate that we observe today, and this could be for any rate that you're looking at, doesn't necessarily have to be an isotopic rate, decay rate, for example. Could be, you know, the rate of erosion from a waterfall, for example. If you're taking the assumption that whatever rate we measure today, it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a dangerous thing when you're talking about thousands, or in case of the age of the Earth, millions or billions of years, because that's a long period of time and nobody was there. Well, actually, Adam was there. But, there, you know, that was only 6,000 years ago and not not the 40,000 that we're talking about here. Now, the dispersion from the Tower of Babel, we have to say, well, when could that have happened? Well, I'm doing a study in my Bible class right now at church, and we just got finished chapter 9 of Genesis, and chapter 10 it talks about the lineage of the three sons, for example. It breaks them, breaks their descendants down. The sons of Ham or the sons of Japheth, for example. And it's interesting, one of the fellows' name is Peleg. And we've talked about this. No, we haven't talked about him before, but his name means division. And it says in chapter 10 that his name was named Division because the earth broke up at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the earth was indeed one big continent, a supercontinent called Pangaea, for example, and began to break up in Peleg's when Peleg was born, or about the time, you know, when he lived, then we're talking about 100 years or so past the flood. So
yeah, you know, I was wondering about that, because that same information is in Chronicles, and that's where I've been reading here the last couple of days, and that crossed my mind today. How could, if he came after the flood, and then the earth divided somehow? That's a mystery to me. So you're saying it was in close enough proximity to the flood that it still could have been a consequence of the flood, correct?
Oh, most definitely it was a consequence of the flood.
Mm-hmm.
Most definitely. It just took a little longer, you know, for the earth to break up. I mean, there were, we know from extra-biblical information that there was rumblings and tumblings even before Noah got into the ark, about a week before, you know, there was a sign for the people to say, you know, something's up, folks, you better get in that ark. So God gave the people, the pre-flood people, ample opportunity to repent and then to go onto the ark. But of course, we know from Scripture that only 8 people went in, Noah and his wife and 3 sons and their wives. So even in spite of everything that God did, people were just apparently hated God so much that they weren't going to go into the ark. So we have evidence that something was happening with the earth even right before the flood. And I'm sure there was a lot of volcanic activity at the time of the flood. And then, of course, with Peleg, you get you get a little bit more information that the earth actually really started breaking up about 100 years after the flood.
So you would define that as the breaking up of Pangaea, then separating into North and South America and European continents.
Australia and the Arctic and the Antarctic. Of course, shortly following that breakup period, or while the Earth was breaking up, you would have much more volcanic activity happening, and that would lead you then into the Ice Age, because the Earth was already, the seas were already warm from the opening up of the deep, the water coming from the deep, for example.
Mm-hmm. It would have been warmer from
at the time of the flood. Mm-hmm. And then the volcanic dust that would have been thrown into the atmosphere during all of this earth movement from the volcanoes, then you would have had tremendous amount of snow being deposited on the earth, and then ultimately about 30% of the earth's surface was covered with snow and ice.
I was thinking it must have been very, very, very challenging for those people to survive those times.
Oh, yeah. You might think, well, you know, if that is going on, you might seek a cave to keep yourself warm and to hide in. What better place? Because if you built a stone house and the earth is shaking, it's probably come down on you.
It's interesting. Interesting then that in Revelation it also talks about people hiding from God in the mountains and in the caves, as if that's the natural place to go when you can't cope with what's happening around you.
Right, and there'll probably be a lot of earthquakes. Of course, God tells us that there's going to be earthquakes in various places when the end is near. It's all interesting, and you know who would have thought that? Well, okay, cave paintings. How is that tied biblically into the information that we find in the Bible? But indeed, it ties very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting article. Again, it's over at Smithsonian.com, and when we put up our conversation as a podcast a little later this morning, this article will be appended. You can link to it and go read it yourself. If you'd like to find it on your own, well, it's kind of a long address, but it's SmithsonianMag.com is the website, and you can search for cave paintings, perhaps, and it would pop up for you. Otherwise, we'll have a link for it on our website, BrokenRoadRadio.com. There's a little tab at the top that says podcast. You go to there and then click on Dr. Don's name, and you'll find this right at the top of the list, today's conversation. That'll happen in 2 or 3 hours, I imagine. Don, interesting, and I'm just looking at the paintings themselves is worth the trip over to that article today. The idea that I'm looking at the silhouette of a human hand from so long ago, and apparently done with art in mind, unless just painting the back of your hand was the thing then, you know? Did you ever think of that?
Oh, well, and this was just...
that was just, yeah. Here, put your hand here. I'll get it painted for you.
This could be the voter registration spot, too.
Hey, there you go.
You know, and we do this today. We don't necessarily leave cave paintings, but we do it on paper with our kids. And, you get the handprint of your whole family. And it wouldn't it be interesting that, obviously, these people were related, that they did... Way back then, they were doing the same thing.
Yeah, even more interesting.
They were leaving the handprint of the family.
Yeah, even more interesting than the fact that they were creative and could do art on the walls was why they may have done that.
Exactly.
I mean, maybe the animal paintings, it was a taxidermy shop, you know?
So could be advertising.
Yeah.
Early form of TV.
Yeah, just, trying to leave your mark. you know, on the world, and these folks obviously did it.
Mm.
Of course, they find, you know, animal sketches as well.
Oh, so. Yeah.
Pictures, yeah. Right.
Some of these are pretty impressive. So I want to recommend, too, that you visit creationmoments.com. It's quite a website, Creation Moments. You'll find science there that supports the young Earth creationist position. And it's science that doesn't normally get heard outside of these circles. It gets shouted down, it gets erased, it gets unpublished, and it gets beaten down, and unfairly so, because there's some fine minds behind that. And it's not superstition. There's science on the side of that argument as well. And it's creationmoments.com. If you're so inclined, you can link to it from our website at brokenroadradio.com. Don, as always, thank you very much for dropping by. Good to have you.
Oh, well, it's fun as usual, so thank you very much.
And we'll catch you next week, okay?
All right, Don. Sounds good. Bye-bye. So long.